Welcome back to the Joomla Network podcast, where we lead with a listen. I'm your host, Russell Fugit, Chief Encouragement Officer, and I'm so excited to have you here today. We have a short interview with our friend and our technology partner, InclusionScore, and its CEO and founder, James Felton Keith. Just last week, we had a New York Times article, op-ed, that spoke to the fact that training in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion may in fact be doing more harm than good. And that's why we here at Joomla Network are encouraging organizations to get an assessment, not just any assessment. It's not the Russell Fugit assessment. It's not even the Joomla Network assessment. It is the global assessment as defined by the International Organization of Standards, paper 30415, which was released and published in May of 2021. The International Organization of Standards, for those of you who may not know, is a governing body consisting of over 100 representatives of over 160 nations, and they come together and make standards on all kinds of things. A lot of it has to do with, historically, it's been engineering and various scientific fields, but there also is a very strong human resource component. And our friends at InclusionScore were, in fact, a part of the process, and it was a multi-year, multiple decade process of arriving at the global consensus for diversity and inclusion. You can look it up, ISO paper 30415. And we're so excited to partner with InclusionScore, which has a software tool that leverages the standard to create a methodical process for driving diversity and inclusion forward within your organization. It truly is risk management. So, jump in, tap in for this real short but powerful conversation with my friend James Felton Keith, the founder and CEO of InclusionScore.
What if diversity trainings are doing more harm than good? It was an op-ed, correct?
Right. So I shared that op-ed with, you know, Dr. Dawn Bennett Alexander. She was, you know, she's like, you know, I agree with some of the, you know, some of the comments. I was like, look, I agree too. Again, it was one guy's perspective. It is an op-ed. But at the same time, you know, as we go around, like every company I talk to, they express a sense of burnout from sourcing in TED Talks, right? Whether it be from Black women or disabled folks, or the now I think I'm seeing a huge rise in the, you know, neurodivergent community.
Sure.
Or whether it's LGBT or whether stuff is tied to particular months. Like I know February is coming up.
Right.
I'll probably get, you know, a lot more taps than usual to, hey, sure, speak your piece, yeah, you know, Women's History Month after that, at least here in the United States. But, you know, that stuff doesn't move the needle on how a company makes individuals within that company feel, you know, affirmed and included.
Right.
So, you know, I always go back to, so this is where Dr. BA and I did agree, which was, yeah, you know, it's not structurally transformative enough, and it's regularly premature, right? Mm. So every time I see, like, even when I get called in for a talk, you know, we talk about the fee, we're going to come in and do a talk, but I try to express to whoever is trying to bring me in, especially if it's at a private company, that this is not necessarily moving the needle on diversity inclusion. Sourcing in a bunch of TED Talks might inspire some of your younger employees. Mm. If you have a real savvy speaker, it may inspire other folks, but that's not the same as facilitating, you know, inclusivity and seeing what sort of resources they need. And to what we were talking about before, you know, we started recording, it makes me think about a lot of research we're seeing coming out of HR professionals, which is not really the space I identify what we're doing,
right, per
InclusionScore, et cetera. But a lot of HR professionals are expressing burnout from their employee and staff around the standardized trainings to say 75%, it's really about 76%, don't care about D&I. 24-25% do care. And that 24-25% are the real risk to your institution. That's a large number to disrupt, you know, a broader employee population that may not, you know, care too much about their work in general. Also think the phrasing of the language matters, because while only 24 to 25% care about D&I, again, per HR professionals, and what they're reporting, we see 50% across the board in every well-developed country. So the entire West, plus Japan, South Africa, South Korea, Australia, right. You name it. They all say, you know, 50% says that they're ready to leave their jobs. So I think if you were to ask people who feel a little bit less disenfranchised what it means to not have a sense of belonging or a sense of purpose in the work that they're doing, mm-hmm. I think you get some much different numbers. And again, the real risk to that is, as we see in this plateaued recession, at least is the language I'm using for it, as we see job cuts happening, I think our communication, what we hear from the legal community that's interacting with the HR community, is don't leave your employer without a lawyer. Mm-hmm. They're going to find a way to leverage the general disdain in this post-pandemic world,
yep,
and turn that into a revenue stream of grievances, or at least attempting to litigate grievances.
Yeah,
and
they being the legal community.
I mean, they're making my market, you know, for sure.
Right.
And you know, and I don't blame them. I think there is, you know, to use overly financial terms, I think a bit of a cultural arbitrage is necessary. I think too much of the disdain with the regular work environment is going unchecked and unnoticed because people don't think that there's anything that they can do about it.
Right.
The legal community can do something about it, and they can make it, they're basically financializing that. Right. And so companies, I think in this new era, you know, as millennials become the old people and, you know, Gen Z is doing their thing, right, and you got some of those Gen Xers on the border who raise these Gen Z kids,
right,
who are making financial decisions, they have to start thinking about what it means to facilitate an inclusive culture going forward and what that means for the bottom line. So yeah, I'm with that New York Times article, and that it's not only that the trainers are doing more harm than good by isolating people, but they're premature. There's no structure for how an institution of any sort brings about inclusivity. Folks are just doing whatever they think is interesting. Whoever wrote the latest book, whoever is the salesperson,
right, whatever's hot,
Princeton, yeah, is killing it, right?
And it's
right,
like, we should bring them too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, she don't know what she's been doing. She's not a D&I professional. Again, I mean, you probably heard me say this a million times, but I meet people, you know, all across the globe, like, I've been doing this work for 30 years. Like, no, you haven't. There wasn't work to do 30 years ago.
People say doing the work is going around giving talks.
Right. And that's fine. You know, like, yeah, I've been doing that. I've been doing that for 15.
Sure. But
there are about 30 or 40 people who could arguably call themselves D&I professionals to say that they've been doing that for 40 years. If you're not one of those people, you're not in play. Like, you've not been
for the 30 year, for the lifetime achievement award.
Yeah, you've not been doing this, you know. Yeah. This woman, she's like, my daughter has, you know, type 1 diabetes and my son is disabled, and I've been doing this work. It's like, you've been passionate about this for years. I don't want to take away from
right
what from you your focus.
Yeah.
You have not been delivering diversity and inclusion as a professional for years or decades. It's just impossible. And I think the language we use around the professionalization of this field is really important, because I think we're just now getting to a point post-standard where we can identify what it means to professionalize a D&I operation.
Right.
And that's no knock on all the work that everyone has done to get us here. You know, right, like when I reference, you know, Dawn Bennett Alexander earlier, the work she was doing 40 years ago and leveraging, at least in the United States, Title VII to get to, you know, legal woes company by company, then establishing the first employment law book, which is right, essentially a critique of Title VII. Mm-hmm. You know, that takes us into a new era, but, you know, you have to build out that infrastructure, that strife between the institutions and the people trying to, you know, hack up and challenge the institutions first. So outside of people like her, I don't think folks have really been doing this work professionally for so long. And now you know, us young guns, even though I think a lot of people might see us as seasoned folks,
right,
are coming in and participating. I think we're finally at a time where we can standardize and professionalize the industry in the same way that other professions have come along over the years. But first thing you need is a consensus. And there's no consensus about when to bring on your next TED talker to talk about diversity. And I don't know if the audiences care, and again, unless they're young people who are inspired by some professional that they think has been successful, whether it be, you know, per accolades or financially or you name it. I know most people who go to those talks at big firms. I saw a person whose name I won't mention speak at Ford Motor Company, and everyone was leaving like, you know, that was a total waste of time. And it was a killer talk, except for some young people like, oh, I want to do this, do that. I remember being a 20-year-old engineer.
Yeah, ambitious, naive.
Yeah, like, I want to do what that guy is doing, you know? Right. And that's good. Like, that's a part of professional development for young folks. But beyond that, most other people can become a bit jaded and want to see structures in place that invites them to the progress.
Yeah, where is all this going? Yeah, it felt good today. It felt good last month when Black History Month was happening, but where are we going with this?
Where are we really going?
Because my colleague still says something ignorant in the meeting every other week, and no one's saying nothing to him. Right. You know, or whatever, you know, right?
And
the same things are still happening. Someone's getting passed over for a promotion, but we just had a great Black History Month, like whatever, like who cares? Look, I'm trying to get out of here, you know? I'm not going to stay here for the Black History Month talk.
Yeah, I mean, all of that
for this, right? You know,
all of that. And I mean,
the stories I hear when I talk to prospective clients, and a lot of them are women of color most times.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to go back before I know we only have a few more minutes before you got to run. When, you know, you say training is often premature, but I have seen situations where training as at the right amount has initiated a dialogue that then has led to an assessment.
Oh, totally.
So how do you I'm still debating this within myself, within my team. How do we find what's the sweet spot of saying we don't want to do a huge rollout of all this training, but we want to have something that's going to begin a dialogue and get people thinking and talking about this stuff so that we can come in and really do the deep work? Any sense of how do you find, you know, when is a training or a talk going to be the right amount to begin a conversation, as opposed to just leading to training on training on training and the cycle this article talks about, that training may be doing more harm than good?
Sure. I mean, I think about, you know, California, right, this week, and the two shootings in the Asian community there. I can already see a spike in conversations, right, around what it means to be Asian American and all the different factions that exist in there. And where that might go from a diversity and inclusion standpoint after. But when I step back and think about the standard, the ISO 30415 standard, every time that we talk about D&I, it's an opportunity for some form of training. I mean, from a conversational standpoint. So I think it's necessary for everyone to establish what we mean by training. I think by training, we're talking about bringing a general awareness about a topic people are not familiar with to those people, right? And it could be about, you know, the Asian community, it could be ethnic, it could be racial, it could be about gender, it could be about disability, it could be about, you know, neurodiversity, it could be about all these different things. I think in contextualizing where you prioritize building in intentionality in that organization, you add that initial training there. But instead of, you know, a 3-day or a 5-hour or a 3-hour training about what cultural diversity exists,
right,
you make it a 15 to 30 minute primer as you go into why it is necessary to build intentionality. Mm-hmm. And by build intentionality, I mean, we're building policy for why organizations should change. So even when I think about the reverse racism suit against Starbucks per their retail outlets in Denver, Colorado. Yeah. They basically created a faux mandate to hire more ethnic racial minorities. I'm gonna call it a faux mandate because it wasn't a published intentional mandate, right? And so the reverse racism lawsuit brought against them has some legs. Now, reverse racism is an ignorant word. It's like saying irregardless. It's not to say you can't be racist towards white guys, right? Kanye West just was, with the Jewish community and with a bunch of other broader communities.
Yeah.
The point is, what I think saves organizations, to echo Effinis Henderson, the lead convener of the ISO standard, is intentionality. But what intentionality looks like in a tangible way or in the real world is a policy, a micro policy, right? And to establish, hey, we want to really look out, say I'm thinking about a California institution, right? Like PG&E, like their public gas and electricity firm, who we've had a lot of talks with up there. When you say you want to try to affect change with them, right? You lead in with that 30-minute look. We're in mourning about what happened to our community members, whether they're near or far away from us. And we want to design in more intentionality. And you go right into design that intentionality, at which point, when you do that in the different domains of the ISO standard, and it triggers interactions with the different diversity types, and it triggers interactions with the different project types, again, training being one of them, you can more easily deploy why and how you're engaging conversations about those communities. And so whenever I'm talking to any company, you know, like I was just talking to a large insurance company in the UK yesterday, and they were talking about mental health and wellness. And they have a whole mental health and wellness arm in their risk management consulting business, which shocked me.
Wow.
But look, if you want to get the mental health and wellness, and they were referencing minority communities throughout the United Kingdom that don't feel included, and what that might do to mental health inside of their clients, meaning companies that they insure,
okay,
businesses. I was like, well, we know that in order to engage something as personal as mental health, you got to build a lot of other infrastructure around intentionality to show those folks that you're actually going to endeavor to get better for them. So, and they reference companies that exist in a town with 40% minority or immigrant population, but they only have 4% of the company represents those folks. I was like, well, you got to show them something real. You have to policy that in, but you're still having that 15-minute primer. We want to be intentional about engaging the West Indian population, the Indian population, the Muslim population that is migrated up here for a variety of reasons, whether it's economic reasons, whether it's reasons specific to climate change.
Yeah, you know, we'll see more of that. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. So I think to your question, we always start with that cultural conversation, but having the all-out training might come at the end of intentionality per department that gets also handed off to that ERG, which should just be an advisory board to say this intentionality is good or it's not good. Right. And then going forward, in 5 months, we're going to target a specific team, you know, field operations or IT or accounting or whatever to talk about this, because we have a few, you know, Sikh members of that team. Yeah. And people don't know why they wear a turban or whatever it is.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I think you're always starting there and you're really deploying the trainings as a tool post the methodological design of how you want to do it. And you deploy them a tool along with a bunch of other tools. We're going to do some data extraction. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about the world or change? You're going to do some demographic pulls. And you might have some Sikhs in there that you didn't know were Sikhs because they're coming to work, you know. Yeah. They come to work trying to, you know, they dressing it up, you know, hair down, red lips. You know.
Right.
They're like me in a blue suit. I don't know if I want to wear a blue suit every day. I feel like, you know, mine is.
Yeah, no, you would. You might have how many blue suits do you own?
I have 14.
I don't mean Navy either.
Yeah, Navy, 14 Navy. I got a few other lighters.
Okay.
You know, I got some grays, only two blacks and a tux in there. But yeah. I got a lot of blue suits because that's my drag, you know? And I don't mind. You know, I feel like I'm looking decent in it, but I know that I'm trying to project a certain thing.
Right.
So yeah, I mean that even
you're rocking well, brother. You're rocking well.
No, I appreciate it.
Well, I wanted to say, like, you know, one of the sayings my family, my uncle used to use in business, you know, sometimes, you know, ready, fire, aim. And we don't want to be ready, fire, aim when it comes to training.
Yeah.
A lot of organizations do. We want to be ready, aim, fire. And that's what we're talking about with them, having a methodical approach.
Yeah.
To this work and really understanding what we're doing and having the intentionality, like you said. So brilliant.
Yeah, I think we start there I think it catches orgs well. Decision makers at orgs, when you tell them that way, they go, oh, okay.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Like, let us come do something first. We're gonna get you the training you need.
We'll get to it. Yeah, you want to find out some external partnerships, some diversity hiring stuff. We can get to all of it. But let's understand what we're doing and what we want to accomplish and be intentional and set some goals and some objectives, identify the metrics that are going to measure our success, and then let's move down that process thoughtfully and carefully, right? And that's right. The we want to thread, so we don't get the anti-woke lawsuit, and we don't get the lawsuit from the people who are leaving because y'all are, you know, aren't anti-racist enough, right? And that's the needle I feel like I tell people we're trying to thread on both sides. Right. There's a risk element to not doing this the right way.
Right.
There's a risk element to not doing anything at all. But even as we're learning, sometimes doing the training and certain things that aren't in the right order can make it even worse.
Let's keep the conversation going. Absolutely. We still need to do another talk about is this standard merely implementing a big change agent? Like I want to dig deep into those ideas.
Welcome back to the Joomla Network podcast, where we lead with a listen. I'm your host, Russell Fugit, Chief Encouragement Officer, and I'm so excited to have you here today. We have a short interview with our friend and our technology partner, InclusionScore, and its CEO and founder, James Felton Keith. Just last week, we had a New York Times article, op-ed, that spoke to the fact that training in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion may in fact be doing more harm than good. And that's why we here at Joomla Network are encouraging organizations to get an assessment, not just any assessment. It's not the Russell Fugit assessment. It's not even the Joomla Network assessment. It is the global assessment as defined by the International Organization of Standards, paper 30415, which was released and published in May of 2021. The International Organization of Standards, for those of you who may not know, is a governing body consisting of over 100 representatives of over 160 nations, and they come together and make standards on all kinds of things. A lot of it has to do with, historically, it's been engineering and various scientific fields, but there also is a very strong human resource component. And our friends at InclusionScore were, in fact, a part of the process, and it was a multi-year, multiple decade process of arriving at the global consensus for diversity and inclusion. You can look it up, ISO paper 30415. And we're so excited to partner with InclusionScore, which has a software tool that leverages the standard to create a methodical process for driving diversity and inclusion forward within your organization. It truly is risk management. So jump in, tap in for this real short but powerful conversation with my friend James Felton Keith, the founder and CEO of InclusionScore.